welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Thank you, Elena Katz-Chernin, for your theme, which introduces LNL. This is, would you believe, the 40th anniversary of the referendum of 1967, where 90% of Australians voted to recognise Aboriginal people as citizens of this wide brown land, which was very generous and kind of them. And we'll be having a series of discussions with Aboriginal, significant Indigenous people, to discuss the impact of that decision on their lives. And we started tonight with Wayne Bergman, a remarkable young bloke. Not so long ago he was functionally illiterate. Now he's a very talented lawyer who negotiates significant native title deals, and he's also the executive director of the Kimberley Land Council. If you've read or seen, or even the film version of Pygmalion, the film version being, of course, My Fair Lady, you'd be familiar with Mr. Doolittle's complaint about what he calls middle-class morality. He sees it getting in the way of everything. And in our conversations recently about overpopulation, family planning and sexually transmitted disease, one of the recurring themes has been the way this middle-class morality keeps getting in the road of pragmatic approaches to these problems. And on no issue is this more the case than with HIV/AIDS, the disease that's been around for about a quarter of a century, with infection rates still increasing every year. Now, my next guest says that despite the fact that we've known pretty much how to prevent HIV infection for decades, governments around the world are unwilling or unable to face up to the problem. Yeah, a lot of money's being spent. It ain't enough, and the focus is all wrong. And he says this should be a particular concern to us because, as listeners know, there's a looming pandemic right on our doorstep. Bill Botel played an important role in devising Australia's response to the AIDS crisis in the 1980s. He's a former diplomat, political advisor. He helped set up Medicare, so stand to attention. These days he's the director of the HIV/AIDS project at the Lowy Institute, and I, for one, am very glad that it exists. And he's just published a new briefing paper on the looming pandemic in our region. And Bill, good to see you.
Thank you, Philip.
When we think of parts of the world most affected now and in the future, the focus tends to be on sub-Saharan Africa, where all the really horror statistics were coming out for a long time.
That's right. I mean, for the first 25 years, we've lived with a very slow-burning fuse on HIV, and I think we can look at the first 25 years as being the era of the first pandemic, which, as you say, was in sub-Saharan Africa, in places that were small and poor and remote. In the mid-80s, countries like Australia, Western Europe, New Zealand, Canada, got on top of it fairly quickly because we had the structures and the money and the willingness to do something. But in these poorer, smaller, more vulnerable places, for one reason or another, they didn't. So we've had that problem. 65 million people in 25 years have been infected. 25 million have died. But it doesn't seem to have educated the rest of the world about the seriousness of the problem or the need to stop a problem becoming a pandemic. But now, as this thing is spreading out of sub-Saharan Africa, across Russia and Central Asia, into the Asia Pacific, we're looking at a new sort of pandemic.
And it's already a very significant problem in PNG and even in Solomon Islands.
Well, there's PNG. 10 years ago, not a problem. Not a problem. We knew how to stop and prevent the virus then. It was the basis of evidence and science. Everything was there. Had we moved swiftly and effectively on the basis of well-established policies and priorities 10 years ago, PNG would not now have a sub-Saharan African problem.
Are we looking at just ineptitude, or is it a part of the problem we've been discussing a lot on the program recently? Does it come out of, say, the mental state of the Bush administration, or indeed our own laws, which are rather undermined by Brian Harradine, in terms of getting condoms out.
Well, I think you've pinged one of the administrations that helped to create a great problem, the Bush administration, the Reagan administration before that, but the Clinton administration was not much better. America has a very high number of politically significant religious leaders who believe there is a faith-based solution to this.
But it is also a factor in Australia.
Well, increasingly it is. I'm happy to say that whatever Senator Harradine did when he was in office to try to tie things, broadly, governments of both parties in this area over 25 years have been very pragmatic, very practical, and have tried to do their best to talk about harm reduction and minimisation. So that reflects the Australian middle ground, I think.
I had Mal Washer, the Liberal backbencher, on the other night, and he's trying, with others, to get the government to drop the Harradine-era ban on sex education, family planning. So, OK, let's not dwell on it, but I wanted to put it on the table. The look 10 years into the future. Where will most cases of HIV infection be, do you think?
Well, already India has more HIV cases than South Africa, and it took South Africa a long time to get to 5-6 million people infected with HIV. Well, already India has gone past that. China says they have about 600,000 to a million HIV cases, but the statistics are notoriously underreported. So the battle, everything up to now, in my view, to use a Broadway phrase, has been out-of-town tryout. Mm. When you start to talk about HIV and AIDS in India and China and in the rest of Asia-Pacific, you are talking big, big numbers. So the difference between 1% and 2% of the Chinese population affected by this is more than all the people have been affected by HIV/AIDS in the last 25 years.
Your report seems to suggest that TB is now a mode of transmission, a vector for HIV.
What seems to be happening is that as the HIV caseload gets into the 40, 50 million area, it is provoking the emergence of extremely virulent new forms of tuberculosis. Now, HIV and AIDS, the virus, is not easily casually transmissible. It's not transmissible at all by shaking hands or kissing or using a coffee cup or something. It's transmitted by blood-to-blood contact. But TB is contagious. TB is very bad for people with HIV and very bad for people without it. And we're seeing in recent months reports of what's called extremely drug-resistant TB, XDR-TB, emerging in America, South Korea, and particularly South Africa. And this is a real kicker.
And, of course, if people's immune responses are lowered by TB in its own right, they become more susceptible to HIV anyway.
Indeed. Well, I've just been in Cambodia where, according to some statistics, 53% of the Cambodian population who have HIV have TB.
What sort of strategies have been working? Give us some good news.
Well, the great news is it's avoidable and preventable, broadly, if you're realistic about the sexual and drug-taking behaviours of young people. And the core of this problem is that the religious, pseudo-moralistic, perfect world sort of people just say, well, the cure to HIV, why we won't have it, is if you just have sexual fidelity and monogamy and abstinence and don't do drugs, it'll be okay. Well, big deal. It doesn't work.
Now, okay, what about
the question is how you get that into the mind of young people who are going to indulge in these behaviours to do it so they don't contract HIV and AIDS.
Let's take one country and just make it a case study. Look at Thailand. Now, I think their recent decision to break the international patent on AIDS treatment drugs is terrific. Are they getting anything else right?
Well, Thailand historically had a big problem about the same time it emerged in Australia with sex workers, and a very prominent public health authority, Mechai, did sterling job in getting condoms used by sex workers and their clients, and that had a big effect on the rate of increase of HIV in Thailand historically for 2 decades. However, the Thais are now getting a resurgence HIV epidemic because of two things. The war on drugs has made them very reluctant to put into place needle and syringe programs. That is, they believe that if you put in needle and syringe programs, you will encourage the use of illicit drugs, and they've got a big problem of refugees from Burma coming over the border. So for a long time, Thailand was the poster child of HIV and AIDS. It was a developing country that seemed to have it under control, but now it's resurgent because they're faced up to the sex side of it, but not so willingly on the harm reduction side on drugs.
What about Vietnam?
Vietnam is astounding, I have to say. Vietnam and China both seem to have learnt immense lessons from the problem they had with SARS and avian flu. And it seemed to precipitate in both those countries a really realistic and pragmatic approach to these problems. If you went to Vietnam and China 10 years ago, they'd look you in the eye and say, well, we don't have these problems because we don't have prostitution or homosexuality or drug use. Well, that seems to have been given the old heave-ho, and now they are very straightforward and pragmatic. Funnily enough, they still have the same sort of political problems that all countries have, that old blokes who run these things don't like acknowledging sexual and drug-taking behaviours amongst their children, and it's difficult, and they get a reaction and a response, and a negative one from people who think this is not a right thing to do.
Bill, can we, when I say we, I mean Australia, take more of an international leadership role on this issue?
I think Australia is very well placed. It's not the sort of thing one should be triumphalist about. But the truth is, over 25 years, under successive governments of both parties and politicians of all parties and leadership at every level, we got on top of it. So we all own the response to it. It was one thing when the epidemic was effectively in Africa, but now here we are in a unique position. A country that's had it for 25 years got on top of it, and the HIV epidemic is emerging and evolving right where we live.
So will you have a chance to deliver papers or to bang the lectern at these important international meetings in Australia in 2007?
Well, I'll try. There's always a great deal of competition to get to the lectern at meetings. I mean, there's one thing this area is not short of, it's ego and wanting to be heard. But I'd hope Australia would really think seriously at the big meetings we're having this year of putting on the table one overriding goal, and that's the eradication of HIV and AIDS by the end of this century.
The eradication?
Yep. I think
like smallpox?
Yes. I think if it can be capped and contained and reduced, in theory it can be eradicated. Whether we go at it through care and treatment of people with the disease, whether we prevent the people without it. I'm not an epidemiologist by training, because I can hardly say the word, but I do know that if you get to a certain low level, things die out. After the great influenza in 1920, the thing peaked and peaked and peaked, and then over several weeks in America, it just fell away. Well, it won't do that quite with HIV and AIDS, but I think as a long-term but achievable goal, we should say, let's eradicate it. It's something that you would hope that the Vatican, George Bush and Philip Adams and Mrs. Clinton
and Bill Botel.
And Bill Botel.
On that optimistic note, we shall take our leave of each other, Bill, at least for the time being. Bill's the director of the HIV/AIDS project at the Lowy Institute. And how can people get a copy of the policy brief?
Yes, if they go to www.lowyinstitute.org and follow the prompts, you'll get to a copy of the policy brief.
Bill, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Late Night Live, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. Behave yourselves, and after a bit of music, we'll be talking about a remarkable young fella from the Kimberley. If you want to fiddle with the Australian Constitution, that requires a referendum, and you need to get a majority of voters in a majority of states, so very few referenda get passed. But one did in 1967 in a very big way. The referendum that effectively recognised Aboriginal people as citizens of this country, a record yes vote of 90%. On its 20th anniversary, I sat talking to Faith Bandler, one of the activists who worked on the referendum, and I said, Faith, would it pass today? And that sad, beautiful face considered it, and she said, I don't think it would. And I said, is that because we're more racist? She said, no, but racism is better organised. Well, here we are, on the 40th anniversary of that historic occasion. So between now and the 27th of May, which is the exact anniversary date, I'm going to be speaking with a range of Indigenous people from several generations, some born before, others after the referendum, about their lives, how they've witnessed the changes of the past 40 years, or in the case of the younger ones, how they view their lives in relation to the struggles of the past. Now, for example, my guest tonight was born 2 years after the referendum in 1969 in the Kimberley region. I'm looking at a photograph of him now where he looks like a cardinal. He's got a red robe on because he's getting his law degree at Murdoch University. And yet, I've got to tell you, as with many of his generations, he grew up with his grandparents. He dropped out of school early. As a young adult, he could hardly spell or write. But today, Wayne Bergman is an experienced lawyer and is executive director of the Kimberley Land Council. He's been at the centre of many a significant native title negotiation. Wayne's in Melbourne for the launch of a sumptuous new book on the story of Aboriginal law and culture in the Kimberley, and that's where I found his photo. So we've asked him to come into our Melbourne studio for a chat. Wayne Bergman, welcome to our little wireless program.
Thank you, Philip.
You were born in 69. Tell us what you remember about your early childhood in and around the northwest of WA.
Oh, well, life in the Kimberleys was pretty amazing as a young kid growing up. Spent a lot of time with my grandparents. Remember a lot going fishing on the Fitzroy River, out in saltwater country north of Broome in Biggle Bay, going up the Gibb River Road hunting with my uncle. It was a very founding experience, something that I want to ensure my kids experience as well.
Wayne, did you grow up on a mission in town or in the bush?
No, Mum had a Holmes West house in town, and she was a single parent, and that's why I guess I spent a lot of time with my grandparents. I went to school in Derby, and grew up with a lot of people. The town was small. We knew everyone in the town. I think the big controversy in those days for us, from our view, was maybe pinching a cigarette and going under the house and having a smoke.
Exactly the same as the high points of my childhood. We'd never heard of drugs then, had we?
No, I can remember sneaking back from the local picture show once and hiding behind trees because we were worried that people might see us walking in the dark and don't know why we were doing that.
Now, your grandparents were from different language groups, so what language or languages did you have?
Well, my grandfather, his mother is Nyulnyul, up in the Biggle Bay side, and my grandmother is from the Fitzroy River, which is Nyigina. And my grandfather died when I was young, so I had a greater kind of association and connection with the Fitzroy River, the Nyigina side. And the other extended parts of my family, my other grandfathers, took on that responsibility to instruct me in traditional law and culture.
Okay, you grew up with your grandparents. Your real dad wasn't around. What sort of relationship with Mum?
Great. Mum was hardworking. She worked in the hospital. She met my stepfather, who I call Dad, and Dad was an Austrian, and he was a very central part of my life in terms of giving me some strong work ethics. He was a station hand. He drilled a lot of water holes along the Tanami stock route in the early days, and had a very strong relationship with Aboriginal people out in the Balgo, the desert areas, and gradually worked his way further west into the Kimberleys, and that's where he met my mother.
Now, the next question I'm going to ask you seems to me to evoke the famous musical Brand New Day. know, written by Jimmy Chai, because you end up going to school in Perth, a couple of thousand kilometres away.
Yeah, look, it was just expected. There was no questions about it. We grew up in Derby, went to Holy Rosary, the Catholic school, and when we finished Year 7, we were all, a lot of Aboriginal kids went to Perth, went to Palatine Mission, which was who Brand New Day, the play, was based around the early Palatine brothers taking Aboriginal people to Perth and putting them into private schools or schools down south.
Now, the history records that you were pretty good at sport, but you confess that you had to fudge your way through school.
Yeah, well, look, my strong points is, like most young Aboriginal people, I was very good at sport. I was in the first 5 basketball team, the first 15 rugby team, got in the state team, played in the Australian Championships in Brisbane. You know, it was the highlight of my career, but I don't think I had the basic schooling that I needed to really take me to the next level in high school, and I kind of fudged my way through high school, could barely read or write. My reading obviously was better than my writing, but it was very difficult, and I was always hiding that in school. A couple of teachers, I think, became aware of it and tried to help, but I had no idea why I needed to read or write. I wanted to go back home and go hunting and fishing.
Did you learn anything much or anything at all about Aboriginal history at school?
Well, it was kind of growing up in a bit of a bubble, because I can remember in, I think, grade 9, learning a little bit about how Captain Cook came ashore and how he settled Australia and different outbreaks of resistance that happened with Aboriginal people, but we mostly learned about Australia was founded on the sheep's back, that kind of history. So I was always had something unsettled in the back of my mind, how is this so, because I'm of Aboriginal descent, my family was here all the time. How can it have been founded back in when Captain Cook came?
Yeah, that word discovery was always odd, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You didn't realise much about the 67 referendum, did you, till your early teens?
Yeah, no, I can remember as a kid going through my grandmother's cupboard looking for little treats and coming across a citizenship certificate. And I thought it must have been some kind of game or some kind of something, not real. And I started questioning and wondered, how come my grandmother is a citizen of Australia? We've always lived here. We haven't come from anywhere else. And that's when I started, I guess, more of a learning curve about the history of what happened to Aboriginal people in the Kimberleys. You know, and then people started to tell me the stories about how my grandmother's mother was taken away, and there's some early recordings from the Palatine priests in Biggle Bay, how she was crying, how she saw her mother crying, how the police lured away, the Aboriginal tractors lured away and put her on a police wagon and took her to the police station where she was jailed as an 8-year-old girl. I mean, I just don't know how human society can condone such conduct. You know, I have kids range between 10 and 5, and if anyone with kids can imagine having your children reefed away from you, and as a parent, and what happens to those children. It's certainly a very sad and powerful memory that I have of that, and it also happened to my great-grandfather as well, where he was removed and taken up to Pargo Mission. And there's a bit of irony up there with the police, but was kind of trained and grown up as a good Catholic worker for the mission.
So you head off, you quit school at about 15, and you head off to work on cattle stations.
Yeah, well, I kind of had was finding it very hard to readjust to school. I think I just came back from Brisbane and played in the Australian Championships, and was kind of looking for someone to provide me with some leadership to encourage me to stay at school, but there wasn't anyone around, so I end up ringing Mum and saying, I want to come home, and she said, okay, and I came home. So I ended up then working with my father and doing station work, and it was, you know...
This is general jackaroo stuff, is it?
Yep, building windmills, drilling waterhole bores, banging in pickets, really hard work on the shovel, digging trenches, building concrete tanks. I wish I was fit like I was back then now.
Yeah, and you get into a little bit of trouble with Mr. Plod, and you're placed on a community order.
Yeah, look, it was got mixed up. Young boy, drinking too much, did a few wrong things in town, and ended up before the local JPs, and was placed on a community order. The kind of ironicness about that is the local member of parliament, Carol Martin, was the welfare officer in charge of me in those days, and I thought that was quite ironic now in my current position, where I've come from being a little rat bag to having a position of a lot of responsibility and having to work with Carol Martin, who's a member of parliament.
Let us remind the listener that what your job is, executive director of the Kimberley Land Council. His name is Wayne Bergman, and this is Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and the World Wide Web, and more ironies and surprises lie ahead. You leave the cattle station, get an apprenticeship in boiler making and shipbuilding.
Yeah, look, I don't think there's any harder job than working for your father, so after about 12 months...
He's working for my executive producer.
I hightail it out of the Kimberleys and score an apprenticeship back down south past Fremantle, Rockingham, working with, at that time, the Australian Shipbuilding Industries, and they were building a lot of patrol boats for the Solomon Islands, had an Australian government contract. So I spent 3 years down there doing a boilermaker welder apprenticeship.
Then it's back to Fitzroy Crossing. You scrounge around for work and money, and then you get a job at an art centre. Now, this is, when you think back, this is immensely significant in your life, isn't it?
Well, it was those early stories that people told me about first contact, about their country, about responsibilities for it, that really struck a chord with my own identity and my self-discovery about my Aboriginality, about a more deeper cultural side that I was searching for.
First contact. There are still stories about first contact.
Yeah, well, I was really amazed and, you know, kind of thought this was something you would see in the movie, but there's a large number of Aboriginal people in the Kimberley who are still alive walking around today who walked off the desert, some in the late 50s, some in the early 60s. And it's kind of tragic in one way because it's part of Australia's living history. Mm. This is not something that you read in the history books. These are Aboriginal people who are still alive today, and it's really disappointing that we don't kind of acknowledge that history in the Kimberleys is so recent. Mm. And people's connection and knowledge of country is really strong.
And you're involved in documenting paintings as well as secret ceremonial material and human remains.
Well, I was asked to assist moving the Kimberley Aboriginal Law and Culture Centre, CALAC, from Broome to Fitzroy. And in that process, I was fortunate enough and privileged enough to get a job to work as the trainee coordinator. And that involved a whole range of things. And I guess that was my... A stronger instructional level of working for the next 6 years with senior Aboriginal men and women about working in a culturally appropriate way in the Kimberleys, assisting the repatriation of skeletal remains, secret objects, and to see the power and the happiness and the fulfilment of bringing those important things back is really emotional and really important.
Let me backtrack to first contact experiences. Tell us a bit about Old Spider Snell and Dolly Snell.
Well, Old Spider, he's a good old boss. He's probably one of the few senior men still alive. He walked off the desert in the, I think, early 50s, and can barely speak any English, but is a very important cultural leader. And again, one of those strong links back to people living on country. Mm. Part of that Wolmajeri group of Aboriginal people in the desert, there was Mona Juguna and her sister, who have written a book called Two Sisters Stories, that tell a very passionate story about surviving in the bush when all the men had moved off and ended up working in cattle stations and weren't able to return back to the desert except on the seasonal breaks the stations had. And they tell a very intriguing story about how there was two criminals that wandered across the desert who they didn't know what language they spoke, that had captured the women and held them captive for a period of time until the mid-70s, that they were caught moving into closer to the cattle stations, I think on Charabin, where the station owners had captured them and arrested them for killing one of the cattle. And it was, you know, there's some early documented evidence of one of the men finally left the station life and went back in the desert. And there was a field trip of senior Aboriginal people and Aboriginal people with an anthropologist who found the tracks of this old man back in the early 80s, still wandering out there in the desert, and people decided that they would leave him alone out there. And, you know, this is just really powerful, interesting recent history.
It sure is. Now, at this stage of your life, you're the coordinator of the Law and Culture Centre, but your literacy levels are still pretty low. And I understand you had a list of words taped to your desk.
Yeah, look, my literacy levels, I was really embarrassed about what I could spell. So when it came to writing out cheques, I used to have a list of 1,000, 2,000 different names so that I didn't make spelling mistakes when I wrote out these cheques, so I at least looked professional. So that's kind of demonstrates the level of my literacy levels, and it was a very tough time. And really, what I look back and I'm just so thankful and appreciative of the senior people who place such trust in me to move into a responsibility in managing the Kimberley Aboriginal Law and Culture Centre. They obviously saw something in me that they trusted.
Mm.
And
They were right. Yeah. Where they went. So it's great that the old folk did place trust in you. But you had more to do than improve your literacy levels for the Whitefellow Society. You had to go on a very steep learning curve about Indigenous cultural protocols, didn't you?
Yeah, well, those early days in CALAC, I certainly weren't in a position where I was able to deliver the information. Joe Brown, the chairman of CALAC, I had all the what you call technical information or information from letters and what government would write to us about returning cultural material or skeletal remains or a policy issue. And we'd go out bush and we'd go to different communities and all the senior men would come around and make a circle. And I'd have to sit behind Joe Brown, and he would talk in language and explain everything, what's going on, and every now and again turn back to me and say, now, what was that thing the minister said about that? And I'd tell him, and then he'd turn back and speak in language, and all the men would discuss it, and they'd turn back to me and say, okay, this is the outcome, this is what we want you to do.
This is LNL, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, ABC Online podcast, and I'm talking to a fascinating young fellow, Wayne Bergman, Executive Director of the Kimberley Land Council, as part of a series of conversations I'll be having with Indigenous people to mark the 40th anniversary of the 1967 referendum. Now, these problems you had with conventional literacy must have been a huge challenge when you choose to study law. And, of course, you choose to do so because you're getting a bit frustrated with the advice white lawyers are giving about customary law.
Yeah, well, it was a big thing. All the old mob were arguing, and I was seeing traditional law and custom being practiced and in functioning and operating. And I could see the authority structures, and I would be wanting to get advice from lawyers about what we could do to bring in traditional authority a lot more in the Kimberleys. And I wasn't getting the answers that my cultural bosses wanted to hear. So it was kind of a bit of a learning curve about the frustration of dealing with that, that kind of inspired me and by default steered me in the direction to going off to Perth and doing an Aboriginal pre-law course. I did an intensive 5-week course in legal subjects, and if my marks were good enough at the end of that I would get an entry into studying law and choose between those unis.
Well, you did it, didn't you? And you were driven by a fear of failure, you say. So you didn't fail. You get the law degree. And you work with Ian Viner. Not a bad bloke for a politician.
Yeah, well, you know, it was Ian Viner was... it was a very interesting time doing my articles with Ian Viner. He's Queen's Counsel. And had a bit of a history with Aboriginal people and Aboriginal affairs. And so, you know, he was full of information. It was really interesting during my time with him discussing some of the things when he was federal minister that he was involved with, purchasing cattle stations and that in the Kimberley or being part of processes, making decisions that cattle stations and then looking back now that I'm part of my job is dealing with those cattle stations and assisting them in their operations.
So in 2001, an amazing event occurs as a consequence of your hard academic work. You get to replace Peter Yu as head of the Kimberley Land Council. Big shoes to fill.
Yeah, well, certainly KLC had left its mark nationally about human rights, the treatment of Aboriginal people, Indigenous policy, outstations, education. KLC had a full platter of issues to deal with, and Peter was one of the driving forces behind that.
Now, the big issue, or one of the huge issues in the country, let alone the Kimberley, is native title. You've been involved in huge claims and very successful ones, and as I understand it, a massive 35% of the Kimberley region is now covered by native title agreements.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible, the native title determination and to being part of that success story. Some of those native title determinations mark a beginning, I guess, and a challenge for Aboriginal people, traditional owners, to reconstruct the future, rebuild the fabric of their cultural societies, their foundations, and move forward.
There's some good stories, though, aren't there? I understand that a number of pastoral leases have been acquired, that is, bought, and that these cattle stations are now being owned and run by your people. How are they doing?
Well, it's a mixed bag of tricks. Aboriginal people own about 30 of the maybe 80 cattle stations in the Kimberley. Some of them are operating really well. Some of them are small and marginal properties. And so there's a range of properties across the spectrum. The challenge for them is that some of them were bought on the basis of running commercial businesses, and some of them were purchased for social and cultural purposes. So the drama happens when you try to a cattle station that's been bought for social and cultural purposes when you expect it to be a commercial commercial operation.
Mm, mm.
But
having some stations like Leopold, Milliwindi, Fairfield makes it easier to take kids back to the traditional country and teach them traditional ways.
Oh, it's absolutely fundamental. I mean, Aboriginal people owning those stations make their access to them much more easier, makes the ability to pass on knowledge much more easier. We're having disputes in the Kimberley at the moment in some places where cattle station leaseholders are trying to prevent Aboriginal people accessing those leases. And it's a bit like genocide, really. If you prevent people from accessing the land, you prevent them from passing on knowledge. And really, you know, that shouldn't be happening.
Yeah. There's some good news stories, too, in your negotiations with some of the mining companies. I like what you've achieved with Tanami Gold, because it involves employing, training local people, involves them in any changes to the mining plan. There's consultation, quite strong consultation, issues on environmental and heritage matters.
Yeah, look, a lot of these agreements, there's a hard and fair negotiation that happens, and we end up negotiating significant benefits for Aboriginal people to build their own independent economic base. But the negotiations also is the start of a partnership. And it's a funny relationship, because on one side you're negotiating, but on the other side you're setting up a long-term relationship with a mining company. And Tanami Gold, Dennis Waddell, the chairman of Tanami Gold, is someone of such high moral standards, and he has a commitment to do the right thing. And that's why agreements like the Tanami Gold agreement stands out far greater than a lot of other agreements.
It's funny that you mention this integrity, because Marcia Langton was telling me, and others at GAMA, that some of the agreements in that part of the world have been absolutely indispensable to Indigenous kids.
Yeah, definitely. And the better these agreements are they're built on relationships, and because people want to do the right thing. The other most significant agreement that we've got in the Kimberley was with Aztec on Coolin Island reopening an old BHP iron ore mine. And again, in that agreement, it's going into commercial production, and we're seeing Aboriginal people that generally is cut off the list in terms of the level of education or literacy and numeracy level required to get into the mining industry. We're seeing Aboriginal people that would not meet that normal standard being trained up through tailor-made courses because the company is paying for it, because it's an outcome under the Native Title Agreement, where we're seeing those Aboriginal people go into the mines and get jobs, and it's really changing people's way they look at things, their confidence. It's putting a hard day's pay in their pocket for a hard day's work, a good day's pay, I should say, for a hard day's work. And, you know, it is a really positive thing, and I think this is a bit of a revolution in the sense of companies now are seeing working with the Land Council, with the Kimberley Land Council, as a major positive aspect of doing native title agreements, because, you know, we all got to leave the table at some point, and we're setting up a longer term relationship beyond the negotiation. Some of these mines go on for maybe 20, 50 years, and so therefore you need the human capital and the human will to make things happen, because at the end of the day, the legal issues or the words in the contract, they mean something, but it's how people apply them and use them that's going to really make the difference, in my view.
In the time we've got left, Wayne Bergman, I want to raise a couple of quite different issues. Well, not entirely separate, but one of them is the matter of family violence, particularly violence against women and kids. Do you see this as a huge problem? And if so, why has it become so in some Indigenous communities?
Well, it's certainly, statistically, it's there, and it's a huge problem. It's not something being provoked by traditional law. It's something being provoked by social dysfunction, a breakdown of family values, a breakdown of traditional values. And There is not a simple answer to it. There's no magic wand to wave to fix any of these issues. But I think that some of the building blocks. Some of the government intervention programs need to happen more flexibly and easily so that we can get in place programs to start to address some of these social dysfunctions or that lead to domestic violence.
Is it particularly severe in Kimberley region?
Well, I'm certainly being very careful in the sense that there's been a lot of blame recently in the Territory by different senior government officials saying, oh, well, it's traditional law that's being used as an excuse to justify domestic violence. That's certainly not the position in the Kimberley, and I'm certainly don't think it is the position in the Territory. At our last AGM, all the senior men had a discussion about it, and they were absolutely offended that people would be using their traditional culture in a way that would condone the treatment of women and children in the wrong way. And there was strong words being said about that, and as a result of that, there was a letter written to the Attorney General, Jim McGinty, in Western Australia, to say that the senior cultural bosses of the Kimberley, through CALAC, strongly doesn't condone any of these violences, that it's not condoned by our culture.
What about the old law people in the Kimberley? Do they talk about it?
Well, we're all trying to look at ways in which we can address these things. There's certainly discussion about, no one likes people being hurt or their family or their children being hurt. So, people are trying to find ways in which that doesn't happen. And we're finding when people have jobs and they're occupied, they're not sitting around with nothing to doing, feeling stressed, that they have some place, that the level of domestic violence and all that starts to disappear.
I've got the book New Legend, A Story of Law and Culture, The Fight for Self-Determination in the Kimberley. It's a whopper. It is magnificently produced. What's a photograph? Oh, I just found another one of you with the Queen of Sweden. Tell us about the book.
I've been flicking through the book now. I've had an advanced copy since end of last year, and I've been flicking through it, and it brings back a lot of memories, a lot of tears. I feel very privileged and honoured to be able to have served and worked for my Kimberley mob, and that if it wasn't for the support that the Kimberley Aboriginal Law and Culture Centre gave to me to go away and study law, I don't think I would be here with these qualifications and being able to help in the way that I have been. The book is an amazing story about Kimberley Aboriginal people's struggle to protect things that are fundamental and very important to us. And it captures some of the stories of some of our leaders about the struggles that we've been through to kind of maintain our Aboriginal identity as part of Australia. You know, there's no separateness about it, that we're part of Australia. We're not part of multicultural Australia. We're part of Australia's living history, and it's continuing.
Looking at this photo I've just found of you and the Queen of Sweden, I realise that you're there because of this campaign to return remains from Sweden. A very emotional experience. Even to find those remains in Scandinavia.
Well, it was an approach by the Swedish government to repatriate remains from a Swedish explorer that came around and collected skeletal remains from different parts of the Kimberleys, the Fitzroy River, the North Kimberleys and the East Kimberleys. And that was a very emotional experience. I've seen people talk about it, whose remains have come back to their language group, because there's very little identification in those days. And the emotion and the healing that's gone on about what it means to bring these remains back to final rest. It was certainly a very a significant thing the Swedish government had done, and other parts of the world, like England, for example, has vaults of remains of Aboriginal people from Australia. I don't understand the rationale behind holding these remains in such a way in these places. They should be all brought back to rest in their home.
Okay, what's next for you, Wayne Bergman, down the track? A political career as such?
Oh, no political ambitions. I think I just want to make sure that the native title determinations happen in the Kimberley. There are some major challenges in gas development. There's a major challenge with some large companies, Woodside, Inpex, Shell, all wanting to exploit gas off the Browse Basin, the kind of northeast Kimberley or northwest Kimberley, and bringing that onshore. And the Land Council is trying to look at partnerships in the way that could happen, that is protecting our cultural values, our environmental values, and done in a way that's going to deliver a benefit for traditional owners in the area and for the broader Kimberley Aboriginal population.
I started our discussion by talking about a chat I had with Faith Bandler in 1997 to mark the 30th anniversary of the 67 referendum, where she expressed the view that it probably wouldn't pass now, talking about 1997. How do you feel a referendum on that issue would go now?
Well, I think Aboriginal issues have certainly been suppressed. I would hope and have faith that there is still a strong part of Australian society, if they've got the accurate information, would recognise and support Aboriginal people having equal rights, having the same rights to basic human services as anyone else. So,
on that outrageous suggestion, we'll have to wind it up. Thank you very, very much. Wayne Bergman, Executive Director of the Kimberley Land Council, a contributor to New Legend, which is published by the Kimberley Aboriginal Law and Culture Centre in Western Australia. We must have another talk in 10 years' time, Wayne.
Yes, we must. Maybe more recent.
Okay. See you
later.
Thanks,
Philip. Bye.
On our next, I once saw the Lord's Prayer reduced to tiny, tiny, tiny writing on a grain of rice. Something similar has happened with Professor Colin Duckworth. He's reduced Proust's In Search of Lost Time to a 90-minute play. For his encore, he's going to get it down to a fantail wrapper. And we talk about it on the next program. Stick around now on ABC Radio National for the news, and we'll see you later.
ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.